The following is an encore presentation of one of many Financial Sense premium programs, which are available every week to premium subscribers only. For more information on premium subscriptions, go to our financialsense.com website and click on the subscribe link provided.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Joining me on the program today is my special guest, is A. Gary Schilling. He's president of A. Gary Schilling & Company. He's author of the highly acclaimed newsletter, Insight, and also the author of a book called The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. Gary, good to have you back on the program. And one of the reasons I did is an article you recently wrote, Advantage America, because I think it expresses a lot of the things that are going right with the U.S. right now. Let's get into your article, because you list a number of issues here. And some of these things, Gary, I think are very profound. And let's start with the first one, which is demographics, because most people, if we're thinking of demographics, you think of the aging baby boomers. But you had a chart of fertility and life expectancy rates.
Right.
And one of the things that really struck me is if you look at countries like Japan, for a married couple, the replacement rate or fertility rate is about 1.4. If you look at...
You need 2.1 to reproduce, but if you're below that, then your population is dying off.
Yeah, and then if you look at the Eurozone, it's roughly about 1.6, but
right.
When you look to the U.S., it's 2.06, so it's almost at that 2.1.
Right.
Let's talk about the impact that that has on an economy.
Well, it has a tremendous impact because we not only are close to reproducing ourselves, but we also have immigration. In Japan, there's no such thing as immigration. There's no immigration visa. And, you know, the way the world has shaped up in the last 300 or 400 years, we've been importing people, and it's very easy to get into this country, legally or illegally, in comparison with others. And Europe has been exporting people. So, you know, you don't get into Europe very easily. As a result of these long cultural precedents. But in any event, we have the advantage here of not only almost reproducing ourselves plus the immigration, which means we'll have a growing population, we'll have a lot of younger people, and younger people are, you know, they're the ones with the new ideas. They're the people who are paying the taxes and support the old people, among other things. And it allows for economic growth, whereas the other end of the spectrum, Japan, with no immigration, they've got the longest life expectancy of any G7 country, and as a result, their population is already declining, and they have a major problem ahead of how are those who are still working going to produce enough for themselves and for the older people without an intergenerational warfare to split an inadequate pie.
Talk about the emerging world, because, you know, when we think of, you know, the population of the globe, you think of the United States that has something like 325 million. But then you think of countries like India, China, Brazil, Latin America, where a good portion of the world lives.
Well, China, of course, is an interesting country, and China is the only major country that is likely to get old before it gets rich. And that's because of their one child per couple policy. The people in China aged 15 to 24, and those are the new entrants to the labor force typically, that's already declining because of the, as a age cohort, because of the one child per couple policy. So they are really going the way of the developed countries. It's just they haven't gotten the economic status yet. India has no effective birth control, and so that's a different situation. And of course, India is just about to pass China in terms of population. But most other countries, the developing countries, particularly the ones like Brazil, well, South Korea has a very, very low, their fertility rate, I think, is 1.4. I mean, they are very, very low. But as these countries develop, they tend to get lower and lower fertility rates unless they are actively importing people. In other words, ample immigration, they're all going to follow the same path sooner or later.
Let's move on to a second factor that this should be, I think, obvious to a lot of people, and that is the entrepreneurial spirit in the United States. And one of the great things that you've always seen, I mean, you take a look at Apple, the Steve Jobs story, you take a look at social media today, you look at all the great things that we have, whether it's smartphones, it's iPads, it's, you know, the internet, browsers, search engines like Google. A lot of these great things came and originated here in the United States, and I want to get to what that entrepreneurial spirit is doing to manufacturing with the manufacturing renaissance, but let's talk about that compared to, let's say, some of the cultural norms that you would see in, like, China, for example, or Japan, that just, you know, they're great at making stuff and copying things, but they're not great on creating things.
One of the things that got me alerted to this advantage for the U.S. Was conversations with a young Chinese friend. He had grown up in between Hong Kong and Beijing, and he really likes to be in China, but he came over to the U.S. for college. And he told me that he was absolutely shocked when he got here to find that you could question and even challenge a professor. That in China, education is strictly rote. The professor reels off the lecture and you simply memorize it, regurgitate it. There's absolutely no analytical examination, no challenging, no criticism, no dialogue. It's strictly a lecture that is absorbed by the students, and the professor knows everything and they know nothing. And I thought about that, and I said, you know, and I said to him after that, I said, okay, when China catches up with the West by, in effect, putting everybody to work and catching up with Western technology, which they basically borrow or steal, what do they do for an encore? I mean, how does China advance at that point if you don't have a different culture, if you have this kind of rote learning without any entrepreneurial activity? And he had the same conclusion. He said, you know, this is going to be rough for China. They're not there yet, but that's going to be rough down the road. And it's true of many of those other countries, Japan included, that there is really not the willingness to challenge. You know, and Japan has this tremendous respect for the aged and for ancestors. You can say in this country we have too little. The millennia couldn't care less about guys my age, you know. They go to extreme. But the point is that we do not have that kind of cultural malaise, that ossification that I think many of these countries have. And so even though they look very dynamic as they catch up with the West, they really don't have that entrepreneurial spirit that we have, which is going to take them beyond that.
I want to move to something else that you talk about, an advantage, and it's long been noted here, and that is labor flexibility. The one thing that, you know, really drives the U.S. economy as we go through business cycles, if the economy goes into a recession, you see companies cut back on their labor force. And even when we come back, Gary, we're producing a lot more goods today with fewer people. And that speaks a lot to our flexibility. A lot of places around the globe, like Europe, is very calcified with their labor force. So you just can't let a person go. And other nations are that way as well. So let's talk about labor flexibility, which makes it very attractive.
It does. I mean, the U.S. is, again, we have tremendous advantages because virtually everybody here came from somewhere else. We didn't come into a culture that's been around for thousands of years. And whether you want to go back to the Turner thesis, you know, the idea of a frontier and people moving west, and you can always move on if things get a little too organized for you where you are, however you want to phrase it. But I think it is the genius of America. But one of the manifestations, of course, is labor flexibility, because you do have the right in this country to hire and fire. If you look at Japan, for example, it's still by and large lifetime employment. I think one of the things that Japan suffers from is Japan is only about 150 years out of feudalism. Until the 1850s, that was run by the shogun. It was a feudal domain. The U.S. came in there, basically forced them to open up. They threw out the shogun, brought in the emperor back as a figurehead, and went through forced industrialization. But they still have many of the attributes of feudalism, and one of them is lifetime employment. In other words, under feudalism, you belong to your feudal lord from cradle to grave, and the same is true. Well, if you've got lifetime employment, a company is going to be very hesitant to hire somebody knowing they're going to be stuck with them indefinitely, and so there isn't that willingness to take a chance on people. And Japan today, tremendous reliance on part-time people. they don't have full-time positions. It's a very inefficient system. But in this country, we do have labor flexibility, and of course, it's gotten more flexible over time. If you look at unionization in this country, the share of the labor force, if you go back to right after World War II, it was about a quarter of the workforce was unionized. Now it's down to 9%. And, of course, a lot of this has been because of a shift to jobs away from those industrial kind of jobs that are subjective, that are easily unionized, the thousands of people working in a factory, much more to services, to high tech, and so on and so forth, that just aren't susceptible to that. But it has given us a lot more flexibility, because not only do we have a declining unionization, but we have a lot more of the economy based in areas that are more entrepreneurial and where labor flexibility is there. I mean, somebody working in the tech area, hey, those guys move around like nomads. I mean, they may work for Microsoft today and Apple tomorrow and Cisco the next day.
You know, Gary, what about also robotization, too? Because, I mean, you're seeing, for example, Apple set up factories. They're setting up a new factory in Phoenix, Arizona, where, you know, the factories that we're making or building in this country now, instead of, let's say, Joe Sixpack or Larry Lawnmower putting on the bumper on a car, it might be some guy with a white lab coat working behind this big computer that's controlling a $20 million robot.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, this is part of productivity because we are moving to more and more automated production. And that, of course, is the only manufacturing that makes sense in this country. The additive manufacturing, you know, where they build things up in layers and completely saturated with robots and highly automated. In other words, we're not going to see mass production of shoes or textiles in this country. Labor costs are just too great a difference in other costs. But these things that can be automated, that's where the manufacturing is. Now, the good side is that, you know, the plus side is that we're going to see more manufacturing. The negative side of that is, of course, that it doesn't employ a lot more people. And the people that are employed are much more skilled. They have to have a lot higher level of education, training, and sophistication than some guy who's just twisting on bolts in a factory routinely.
I want to move on to the fourth factor that you talk about in your piece, and that is a declining need for financing, especially foreign financing in the U.S. I mean, if you take a look at our budget deficit, we've gone from, what, $1.1 trillion down to about $650 billion.
Right.
You know, and a lot of that has to do with another factor, which is energy. Because if you go back to 2008, you look at our trade deficits, so much of it was in energy. And now we're producing a lot more of it, but we're exporting some of that. So why don't you get into some of the weeds here with this number? Because this is one that I think has surprised a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, in the past, we've had tremendous reliance on foreign financing to basically finance our government deficit and other needs. The way it works out is that our saving internally by consumers and business, offset by government deficits, has been way below our investment. And if your saving is below your investment, where is the gap filled? It comes from abroad. It comes from foreigners who basically are providing the capital. And they're getting that capital, that money, largely because we're running huge trade deficits. It all fits into one construct in the whole accounting. Now, what I think is happening here is that the U.S., we are having less reliance on foreign financing because our trade deficit is shrinking, our current account, because of energy. We're moving toward energy self-sufficiency as opposed to huge imports. And I think we're also seeing the beginning of an increase in the saving rate, consumer saving rate in this country. It declined from 12% in the early 80s to 1% about a decade ago. It's been increasing, and I think it'll go back to double digits. Now, as it goes back, it means that consumer spending is going to be growing slower than income, the reverse of what happened for 25 years. And that means we're going to have a more slowly growing demand for our imports, the rest of the world's exports. For every 1% increase in consumer spending, our imports, the rest of the world's exports, increased 2.9%. That's simply the historic ratio. So as you have, in effect, a slower growth in imports, that will be a factor in also reducing our need for foreign financing. In other words, we won't need to have that many dollars recycled, And at the same time, as consumers are saving more, that money is recycles in the economy, is fungible, and it will end up financing whatever federal deficit we have left. So what I'm saying is that we're moving more toward internal financing of government deficit and other needs as opposed to reliance on foreigners. And that is an advantage because it means there's less risk that you get a financial disaster and somebody out there by mistake starts dumping treasury securities and you get a massive recession, if not depression, out of it. It simply gives you less dependence on the rest of the world.
Gary, can you elaborate a little bit more why you think the savings rate is going up? Is this a reflection of the baby boomers, two bear markets, people heading and realizing they need to save more for retirement? What's driving that?
Yeah, there are a number of factors that are working to increase the saving rate. One is the post-war babies. They've been notoriously poor savers. These people, on average, if you look at the numbers, the average post-war family has a median, this is the one in the middle, half above, half below, has a, surveys indicate they have a income of $91,000, a total family, and they have financial assets of $89,000. In other words, they have less than 1 year's income in financial assets. Well, that plus Social Security and any pensions they might have doesn't make for a very good retirement. So these people are under tremendous pressure to save more. And, of course, a lot of them are going to end up working a lot longer than they thought, and that's already true. The labor participation rates of those over 65, in other words, the percentage of them who are either working or looking for work, is increasing because they simply cannot afford to retire. So that's one very key reason for saving it. Another reason is that people no longer have that equity in their houses that they can suck out to fund oversized spending. The combination of the collapse in housing prices, they went down a third. They're still down despite the rebound. They're still down about a quarter from the peak. And the people suck the money out with cash out refinancing, with home equity loans, and with those and the price declines, they simply don't have the equity. You still have about a quarter of residential mortgages are underwater. The mortgages are bigger than the value of the houses. So they don't have that as a funding source. Another thing is stocks. I mean, people in the 80s and 90s looked on their stock portfolios as the substitute for saving out of wages, salaries, and ordinary income. They basically said, hey, I don't need to save. The stock portfolio is going up forever. And from 1995 to 1999, 5 years, the S&P 500 went up over 20% in each of those 5 years. So people said, I don't need to save, that the stock portfolio will take care of early retirement, send the kids through college, fund a couple around-the-world cruises in the meanwhile. Well, then we had the collapse in stocks after the dot-com boom broke in 2000, and again after the housing boom broke in 2007. And those are two of only five declines of over 40% in the S&P 500 since 1900. The other ones were the 29-32 decline, the 137-38, and then the 73-75. So you've had two of five in over 100 years. And that shook people's confidence in their portfolios, and they no longer believe that the equity portfolio would act in lieu of savings. So you've got a number of factors here that I think are spurring people to save. Now, of course, right now, a lot of people are stressed to save because they've lost their jobs, or if they have and they've gotten another job, they might be working for less money, and they're having trouble making ends meet. But the saving rate has increased even with the recession and slow recovery and declining real inflation-adjusted income, showing, I think, a tremendous underlying power to push up the saving rate.
You know, I want to go on to something that I think out of all the factors you list here has been the one that has surprised a lot of listeners to this program, and that is a strong dollar. And the argument is, you know, we hear it all the time, Gary, that the dollar is going to crash. You know, you take a look at the Fed's quantitative easing. You take a look at, you know, we were running trillion-dollar deficits. You make the case, which, and I believe this is the fact, the case for a stronger dollar. You know, one thing that stands out to me, if you think the dollar is going to collapse and you should be out of the dollar, then I would ask, into what else? Are you going to be in the euro? Are you going to be in the yen?
You know, this is sort of a push and a pull argument. The, the push argument, you might say, is this idea that, you know, what's the alternative? And you can say, well, in that case, you know, the dollar is the tallest midget. It's the slowest falling rock. It's the cleanest shirt in the laundry. Or my favorite is the dollar is the valedictorian in summer remedial school. You can look at it that way. But you also can look at it, and I think in the long run you should, in terms of the positive aspects of the dollar. We did a study going back over a year ago in looking at currencies that were the dominant world currency going back to ancient Roman times, when it was Rome, at least in the West. And we discovered six characteristics that, in effect, are found with the world's leading currency, the reserve currency. And let me run through those briefly. The first one is that currency is usually of a country that has rapid growth and economic productivity. It's an economy that is moving ahead. It has strong productivity. And the U.S. is clearly has the strongest productivity. You look in the last decade, 2000 to 2010, U.S. productivity growth averaged 2.2%. And this was not a great decade, but 2.2 in the U.S., Japan 1.6, U.K. 1.2, Germany 0.9, Canada 0.9, France 0.8, Italy flat, zero. So the U.S. is ahead in that department. A second characteristic is having a large economy. It's usually the world's largest that has a dominant currency. And there, obviously, the U.S. is head and shoulders. I mean, our GDP in 2012 was $15.7 trillion. China, the closest, was 8.2. And China, a lot of people have said China's going to catch up. Well, China would have to grow, if the U.S. economy grows real GDP 3% a year, China would have to grow 12% a year for 20 years to catch up with the U.S. And China isn't going to grow that fast. You know, China was growing at double digits. It's now down to about 7.5% growth. And as the Chinese economy shifts away from being driven by exports, which is no longer working because the U.S. and Europe just aren't growing to the speed that they're going to absorb all those exports, as they shift to a domestic-led economy, away from infrastructure, away from heavy borrowing and so on, their growth is going to grow even more slowly. So the U.S., I think, is going to continue to be the leader. The third characteristic is deep and broad financial markets. And there, if you look at equity capitalization of the U.S., NASDAQ and NYSE, it's $23 billion. Eurozone is $6.5 billion. Japan, $4.5 billion. London, $4 billion. China, about $4 billion. I mean, you know, nobody even close. And then you look at government bond markets, U.S., $13.8 trillion, Eurozone, about $9 billion. Japan, which has very heavy government debt, but it's only $7.4. In other words, in terms of available of financial instruments to trade, U.S. is way ahead. A fourth characteristic is free and open financial markets and economy. And I think we clearly lead the world there. You know, and that's where investors want to go, to places that are free and open. They don't like China. China periodically freezes the currency. They did that, for example, during the Great Recession. They had let it float up, but then they froze it when they got worried. They're now letting it float a bit, but they turn it on, they turn it off. Other currencies are much less free to people moving out. I mean, they typically manipulate currencies in a lot of places. The Swiss, for example, you know, everybody loved to be in Switzerland, but they froze their currency 1.2 to the euro when everybody wanted to be in the Swissy, because they worried that a strong currency would kill their exports to the Eurozone, which is their major trading partner. Fifth characteristic here is a lack of substitutes. And, you know, things can change over time, but if you look, one statistic that I think is very important is global forex trading. Now, there are two sides of this, so the total numbers add up to 200%, not 100%, because for every sale there's a buy. But if you look at the trading, in 2001, the U.S. dollar accounted for 90% of all the daily trading in currencies. In 2013, it's down from 90% to 87%. But you think of all that's happened during that time. The euro currency has come in there. China has gotten stronger, et cetera. But it still has only declined 3 percentage points, and it's way ahead of anything else. The second one today is the euro, 33% versus 87%. The yen, 23%. sterling, 12%. In other words, this is the currency where people transact, and you have a lot of times, you know, let's say if Nigeria is doing business with Brazil, they're going to do it in dollars, even though it's not the currency of either country. The sixth characteristic here for a strong currency is credibility. And that's the only one where you can say there's been any questioning of the dollar. And it is true that that last year Standard & Poor's did downgrade the dollar from AAA to AA+. But that hasn't really hurt. You might remember when they did that, the Treasuries actually rallied when they did that the day they did that and in subsequent trading sessions. And it has not changed the willingness of foreigners to put money into dollar-denominated assets. So the credibility issue is the only one that is not absolutely AAA, but it hasn't had any decided effect so far. So I think for those six reasons, they have historically been important in terms of what happened in ancient Rome when the Byzantine Empire ran things, when the Italian city-states like Genoa and Venice did, when the Brits did in the 19th century. But really, since the beginning of the 20th century, the dollar has been dominant, and I think it's still going to be for, well, as far as I can see ahead, anyway.
And then let's talk about the sixth factor, which you refer to, and that is basically what's going on with this country in terms of energy.
Yeah, that's a very interesting characteristic, because if you go back to, well, even 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of people believed that we were going to see continual increases in our dependence on imported energy. And it goes back to a phenomenon called Hubbert's Peak. This was named after a geologist at Shell Oil back in the 1940s, M. King Hubbert. And he looked at oil fields, and he noticed that there was a predictable pattern of the rising production in an oil field, and then it would peak out and it would decline in a predictable way. And he projected that to the total U.S., the lower 48, and correctly forecast that our energy output would peak in the late 60s. Now, at the time, in the 1940s, oil in Texas was just flowing out all over the place, and everybody thought the guy was nuts. Well, it turned out he was correct. And his followers then, he's long dead, but his followers then extended that sort of analysis to the whole world. And they predicted with what they thought was unrefutable precision that the world was going to hit global energy production in 2011 or 2012 at the very latest. And some of them even pinpointed it to the month. Well, of course, what they did not anticipate was development of alternative sources, the oil sands in Canada, for example, and, of course, natural gas with fracking and horizontal drilling and oil as well. And they also did not forecast the decline in consumption. And consumption in this country has been declining in the last 5 years, both because of the weak economy, but very importantly because of conservation, more energy-efficient cars and appliances, etc. So what we are seeing there is that we are moving toward energy independence from imports. Now, we'll get there a lot quicker in North America than we will in the U.S., and North America is where I think you should concentrate because, you know, that's where the safe energy is. And now that Mexico is really opening up to foreign exploitation of their vast energy reserves between U.S., Canada, and Mexico, I think we will probably see energy independence. In other words, we will net be an exporter of energy, or at least flat, probably by the end of this decade. The U.S. may take longer, but I don't think that's the way to look at it. It's North America. And that means that's a very important change geopolitically, because it means that we no longer have the necessity of basically policing the Persian Gulf. Now, we probably are going to stay there because we don't want the Chinese to move in, and they probably would if we pulled our carriers and other warships out of there and troops out of the Persian Gulf area. But it means that we don't have that need to police the rest of the world nearly to the degree that we have in the past to ensure our sources of energy. Now, having said that, though, one very important point beyond that, and that is the price. Even though we may achieve at some point, at least in North America, energy independence in oil, we probably will still be subjected to global prices. because oil is, it does move in and out of countries. In other words, even if you're energy independent, you still will be exporting oil from some areas, importing in other areas, and therefore subject to global prices. So if you got a big blow up in the Middle East, prices will probably go up in this country. That's very different than natural gas. Natural gas is local markets because it costs a lot of money to liquefy natural gas to send it around the world. And that's why you have vast price differences. In this country, for 1,000 cubic feet, natural gas costs about $4. In Europe, it's $10 to $15, and in Asia, it's $15 to $20. So natural gas is a much more localized market as opposed to oil. So energy independence in terms of production and consumption is not the same as isolation from price.
Let's talk about these six. When you add them all together, when you talk about demographics, you talk about labor flexibility, you talk about energy independence, a strong dollar, entrepreneurial spirit, all these things added together, what does that mean going forward as an investor? If I was to read this report, which really tells me if I'm looking around the globe, I want to be invested in this country. I think we have so many things going for us, but what does that mean for an investor?
And by the way, if anyone is interested in a copy of the full-blown report, they can certainly get in touch with us, and we'd be happy to send them a complimentary copy. And we do have a toll-free number. It's 1-888-346-7444. They can call there during regular business hours, and we'd be happy to provide them a complimentary copy. They can get all the details of the analysis that went behind these reasons that we think America has tremendous advantage in the world.
And I highly recommend our listeners take advantage of it. Once again, you know, going back to the original conversation, I remember reading your book in 1982 that really changed the way I thought about things. And I thought this report, Gary, was a game changer because you sort of consolidated and put in one place all these factors. And there's not just one. You can't just say, well, gosh, it's because we're energy, becoming more energy independent. It's all of them collectively that make up this. And that's why I think it's really one of those reports that is a game changer. Gary, let's talk about the implications for this.
I'm not a America first or my country right or wrong, chauvinist, anything like that. You've got to look at investing on a global scene, and indeed we do in the portfolios we run. We're all over the world. But I think what it means in a longer-term sense is that investors ought to think very carefully about the U.S. as being a prime place for investment. Now, one of the things that I would point out just to illustrate that is that recently you've had a lot of interest in developing countries, you know, Brazil, South Korea, Indonesia, India, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what's happened, we've had slow growth in Europe and the U.S. in the last few years. This has been a very sluggish recovery. We're still in what I call the age of deleveraging, and that's the title of my most recent book, The Age of Deleveraging: Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. We're about halfway through that decade. But the point is that I think people have said, well, you've got slow growth in the Western countries, so let's go to China, let's go to India, let's go to these other areas where they have faster growth. Well, what people, I think, don't realize is the dependence of those countries on the U.S. to take the exports, which are what drives those economies. And, you know, that's part of this whole thing. In other words, if the U.S. is robust, you not only have the U.S. as an advantage, but you also have the fact that these other countries depend on the U.S. And now they're trying to convert to more domestic-driven economies. So that's one of the things I think you keep in mind. And so I think there ought to be a heavier weight than you might otherwise have on U.S. investments for all these reasons, because I do think that we're going to see stronger growth, more solid growth, less dependent on the whims internationally. And gosh, you look at what's going on abroad. Look at Brazil, for example. Brazil is just a pawn on the international financial chessboard. I mean, earlier, all the hot money rushed into Brazil. So in 2010, they put taxes on foreign ownership of bonds to discourage money coming in. But what happened recently after the Fed talked about tapering, cutting back their monthly purchases of $85 billion in May and then in June? The hot money rushed out of Brazil. They had to take off those limitations on foreign investors. They had to jack up interest rates. I mean, they're running for cover. I mean, those are countries that And these countries like Brazil that have big current account deficits, you know, when the money leaves, they don't have any cushion to stand that outflow. And, you know, so I think there are a lot of things that are going on that say you not only have the pull of the U.S., but you have a push of very unattractive situations in many other parts of the world.
So, Gary, as we close, can you do two things? Why don't you give out that phone number again if our listeners would like to take advantage of your offer, which I highly recommend?
Sure. It's a toll-free number, 1-888-346-7444.
And I also recommend, if you have some time, pick up a copy of Gary's book, The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. We've been speaking with A. Gary Schilling. Gary, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Always great to speak with you, and always I love when you put out these thought-provoking pieces, because that's what they are.
Well, I'm delighted. I think it's been a great conversation. I appreciate your interest, and I hope our listeners find this useful as they look ahead in shaping their business lives, their personal lives, and their portfolios.
Well, listen, all the best to you, sir. Once again, thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
That concludes my interview with A. Gary Schilling. And, you know, one of the things that I like about Gary, that he wrote a book back in 1982 when I just had been in this business a couple of years, and it really shaped the way I thought. And because I was coming into a business at a time we had just gone through double-digit inflation, interest rates were at double digits, oil had risen from, you know, $1 to $40, gold had gone from $35 to $800, we were running big budget deficits. And, you know, a guy by the name of Paul Volcker came in and Reagan became president, and it was reshaping the forces that would drive this economy going forward. We had gone from a period of double-digit inflation and all the reasons that caused it to a period of what I call, really, I don't know if I would agree with Gary that was deflation, but it was certainly disinflationary in the sense that we had gone from double digits to low single digits. And that, think about how that transformed the investment markets. We had gone from investing in hard assets, commodities, gold, silver, oil, to probably the two best decades in stock market history. We had a great run from about August of 1981, when the Dow was around 700, all the way up to 11,000. And of course, today we're close to 16,000. And Gary, to his credit, became bearish on the economy and the markets much earlier than many of his peers. But we know what happened in 2007 and 2009. He's been still in that disinflationary camp. But this was, I think, a piece that sort of puts all these items that are driving and explaining, not just tapering, because that's part of it, but why the U.S. has been one of the best places to invest in over the last 5 or 6 years, why our markets are outperforming, why the dollar hasn't crashed, and why these forces remain in place and are likely to remain in place going forward. These are transformational changes, things that are going to bring about different outcomes than most people expect. And do yourself a favor. He's made this report free. Take him up on that offer and read it for yourself. You may agree, you may disagree, but it's going to give you another perspective to look at, and especially if you're in a bunker in the gloom of doom camp and you're puzzled somewhat about all these things that are occurring in the country and why the market has gone up as much as it has. But do yourself a favor, take advantage. It's free. What do you have to lose?
Well, Jim, I keep wanting to post on our website Carol's recipe for brandied cranberries. It is to kill for with Thanksgiving dinner. You cook it in brandy and brown sugar, and it's wonderful. So I hope your Thanksgiving weekend's going well.
I do, too. You know, if you're listening to this program, we will have some feedback coming in from what we've seen on Christmas holiday sales. I expect they're going to be a lot better, John, than most people expect, just given the fact of the rise in the stock market, housing prices. I mean, you know, I don't care if you're an average guy contributing to a 401k program, a 403b, or a 457 program with the government. When you see those monthly statements go up, as they've been doing recently, how can you not be positive? And so those things, I think, are coming. Like I said, I don't see anything on the radar screen going into the end of the year. I don't expect much out of the Fed in December. I just don't see them throwing a monkey wrench to all of this and becoming Scrooge and spoiling the Christmas vacation. But who knows? We'll have to wait and see. And who knows what happens. But anyway, a lot of that coming forward here in the month ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. But hope if you're listening to this program, you had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. It really is a time to be grateful for the things we have. And certainly we've all been blessed with the markets this year, with one of the best stock market years and the highest recorded increase in wealth in this nation's history. When you take housing prices and stock market, adding it all up together. But we have run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we want to wish you a pleasant holiday weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of one of our Financial Sense Premium programs, which are available every week to premium subscribers only. For more information on premium subscriptions, go to our FinancialSense.com website and click on the subscribe link provided.